Want to continue along the discussion of sin, evil, and salvation. We were just discussing, and it's, I think, an important thing for us to look at, is the idea of original sin. Because original sin is something that we, in the Christian world, talk about a lot. And it actually is found in the Old Testament. And it's, I think, important for us to take this into consideration, in particular, as we discuss the idea of sin, evil, and salvation. The thing that I want to start with by saying is that always where you have things that happen, there is the option of redemption. God dismissed Adam and Eve out of the garden in order to redeem them. And even in every event where there was some action of sin or evil, there was a means by which redemption could occur. And so the whole idea in the Old Testament is that God is a God of redemption in the face of sin and evil. And God will provide a means of redemption for those who are seeking redemption. So, essentially, what original sin is it is a distortion of human nature, and it has both an internal element and an external element. Internally, there is a tendency in the human heart to do evil and to follow a deceitful heart. You see this very clearly expressed in the book of Genesis, in Genesis 6, at the time of Noah, which talks about the imaginations and the thoughts of the heart being constantly oriented toward evil. The flood did not wipe that away. And yes, I do believe there was an actual flood. Some people question that today. But the flood did not wipe that away. And in fact, the story of Noah, after he came out of the ark with the three sons and the cursing of one of Noah's sons, Ham, is a kind of a reminder of the fact that the evil, or at least the inclinations of the heart toward sin and evil and deceitfulness, continued after the flood. The flood did not wipe that away. The flood simply led to a new start, you might say, for humanity that really what it does is it tells us that even if people were to start all over again, you would still have the issue of sin and evil to have to deal with, because the flood could not wipe that away. That is something in the human heart. But the Old Testament traces the situation not only to a person's youth or their childhood, not even to birth, but it traces it back to conception. You see this in Genesis 8:21, Psalm 51:1, Psalm 51:5. And Psalm 58:3. Externally, this sin, original sin, is the result not of occasional deviations from what is good, but the consistent outcome of a heart that is tended toward evil. And so the only true and complete remedy for this situation in the Old Testament is for a new heart that has been transformed, and that is an event which the Old Testament sees as happening in an eschatological age. You see this in Ezekiel 11:19. You see it in Ezekiel 36:26, Jeremiah 24:7, and Psalm 51:10. In the time period between now and the eschatological age, what do you do? The Old Testament answer to that is obedience. Obedience to God as He reveals it to the people, which for the Old Testament means obedience to God as revealed in His law. And so you find the law of God playing a very big role. From Leviticus onward, it plays a very big role in the life of the people in the Old Testament period. And the law includes both the Word of God, the actual specific laws, of which there are over 600, and the religious cultus, meaning the temple, the priests, the sacrifices, and all of that. The prophets also are there to help bridge this gap, you might say, between the sinful heart and those who believe God's word and seek to obey. In the Jewish world today, arising out of this, there is the notion that what one does as a matter of practice will eventually affect what one believes. So to practice obedience externally will eventually make someone obedient from the heart to God. This is the Jewish perspective as a result of this perspective on sin and original sin in the Old Testament. And this is, from the Jewish perspective, how the issue of sin is overcome, by obedience. The Christian world understands the entire process in the reverse. First, you get a cleansed and renewed heart, which overcomes sin, and then what happens is that the ways of thinking and living are changed because of a heart that is increasingly drawn close to God, not through external acts of obedience, but through an internal relationship with God. A couple of other aspects of original sin related to the Old Testament. The first is, original sin is not intensive, because if original sin was intensive, that would mean there would be nothing redeemable. So the other thing is, original sin is extensive. It goes out to every aspect of the human condition. But it is not intensive, which means that even though it has spread out throughout all of life and everywhere, it is still possible for redemption to occur. The so sin, original sin, if you want, or sin is not genetically or biologically transmitted as such, but rather it is a state of the human condition present from the time there is a soul in the womb and continues from that point on until the end of a person's life, when, of course, at that point, that person no longer is associated one way or another with sin. And they go on to whatever is going to happen to them afterward. Now, we were talking about a question. Ask your question again so we can have it on camera.
The concept of evil, when it comes to the Lucifer, mm-hmm. from where Lucifer got mm-hmm. that concept there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Shortly.
Yeah. The question is, if everything God created is good, where does evil come from? Well, the actual answer that a lot of people today will give is, well, actually, God was the author of evil, too. Otherwise, how did evil happen? If you read in the passage in Isaiah regarding Lucifer, what it says is, in essence, that Lucifer was the light bearer. He was the top of all of creation until rebellion was found within him. The rebellion was pride. And he, you will see the passage known as the six I wills. And it concludes with him saying, I will ascend to the mount in the north. And that he would be God. The whole thing is that there was pride that just kind of exploded within him. And this is the only way that I know in a demonstrative way to explain about the introduction of evil into that which is good is to take an example that sometimes occurs in our world. It may not happen here in Estonia, but particularly in the southern United States, sometimes people will have like they've worked on a car or something like that, and they have a cloth that has a lot of oil on it, like automobile oil. And they leave it in a hot room during the summer. And what can and sometimes does actually happen is that this cloth is laying there. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with the oil that is in the cloth. But all of a sudden, it explodes in fire. It just reaches a certain moment where it just goes up in fire, and it can burn a house down doing something like that. And there's no actual match. There's no actual cause. It just suddenly explodes in fire. And this is essentially the way the Old Testament shows evil as coming into existence. It just simply occurred, not something that was created. And I think maybe we make a mistake when we talk about evil as being something that was created. Evil is not created. It just simply starts to happen. And the Old Testament focuses not so much on the creation of evil as it does how do you respond to evil. And the response to evil is one by obedience to God, and ultimately by God's acts of redemption in whatever way he is going to do it. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Now, in addition to original sin, which is transmitted through the inclination of the heart to be separate and apart from God and to live according to one's own will instead, there are also specific acts of sin. There are many words in Hebrew that deal with different aspects of what's known as volitional sin. That is to say, sin that a person chooses to do. And I've given you all of these here. They are also in the notes that are up in the library. And let me just very quickly go through these different concepts of volitional sin that are found in the Old Testament. One, which is known as to miss the mark. In other words, to fail to be like God. And this is similar to the very common word in the New Testament, in Greek, amartia, which also means to miss the mark, to simply not be like God. And it can include lacking respect for others, to intentionally fail in your civil or personal relationships. It can include acts of omission, and it can include specific physical acts of sin. Essentially, to miss the mark carries with it the idea, I am going to get what I want, no matter what it takes or who it hurts. And this is the idea, kata, or to miss the mark. Pasha is to rebel or transgress. It is also a strong word for sin, and it expresses the issue of personal and national responsibility. In the non-religious world, it is an intentional breaking of relationships which disrupt loyalty and peace. In the religious sense, it means a willful disobedience of a known requirement or law of God. It's a rebellion against that which God has said. It can include rebellion against a divinely appointed ruler. It can include idolatry. It can refer to the guilt that is associated with doing these things. The idea can have an ethical and moral dimension in the sense that the sin is directed toward another person. It can also apply to a person who has developed a lifestyle of doing pascha. And so in that sense, it becomes a sinful lifestyle, a lifestyle of rebellion. And a lot of times, we probably, all of us, use the term when we see somebody, we refer to this individual or that individual as a rebel. And it's like no matter what situation they are in, they just simply have a lifestyle of rebelling. And this is, in essence, the concept of pascha, one who is simply rebelling. Rebelling against God, rebelling against established authority. Essentially, they become a god unto themselves, and they make their own law, if you want. Mara is also to rebel, or to be contentious, be always ready to fight or to struggle. Mara, however, is focused somewhat more specifically on the notion of a son's rebellion against the father's discipline. And it presupposes previously a good relationship which gets broken by a spirit of rebellion or contentiousness, that is to say, fighting. Abar means to transgress, essentially to be proud. And in the secular sense, it's essentially disobeying a king's command. In the religious sense, it is disobeying God's known will. Or in other words, making yourself and your thoughts and your decisions higher than those of God. Mayan is to refuse to obey a command, to defy, somewhat like the other ones for rebel. Maas is to reject in the sense of contemptuously dismissing God's claims. So it's a little bit like Mara or Abar, to with a very negative attitude to rebel or reject God's claims on a person or on a situation. Maal is to act treacherously or unfaithfully, to betray a trust. And this can be in the legal sense. It can have to do with things such as marriage or legal contracts of any kind of a sort. In the religious sense, Maal is to be unfaithful toward God, to act in a negative way toward God. Avon is to bend or twist, to bring guilt upon oneself by doing an act that twists things, it bends things, it produces guilt within the person. Sometimes it is used along with some of these other types of sin. And if you remember, we talked about the fact that in the sacrificial system in the Old Testament, people, when they would make sacrifices, you always did a sacrifice for sin and you always did a sacrifice for guilt. And so there's kind of a parallel to that with Avon, where A lot of times it is used in association with one of the other words for a particular type of sinful action. Shaga is to err, to commit an unwitting sin. It's close to the idea of unintentionally committing a sin. In the non-religious world, it is connected with actions that were not premeditated, that were not intended, that were not thought out, but it just happened to have a bad consequence. In the Old Testament, if a person commits shaga, that person could go to a city of refuge. There were 10 different cities in the Old Testament that were set up as cities of refuge. And if a person, let's say, quite by accident, killed or injured somebody, or let's say, killed the ox of somebody, then one of the things that they could do, more so it would be if they killed a person accidentally, they could go to a city of refuge, and the family of the person who died could not take vengeance on the person who committed that act while they lived in the city of refuge. And if the I think it was the high priest died, then after that, the person was allowed to leave the city of refuge, and if the family took vengeance upon the person, then that family was guilty of committing an act of homicidal murder and would themselves be subject to execution. So shaga was the mistake, but without a wrongful intent. In the religious sense, it is intended to contrast with the idea of sin of the high hand. Sin of the high hand is raising your hand and intentionally sinning. Shaga is not an intentional sin, but it is still a sin that occurs. It's basically more on the order of a misguided act by a sincere person, but that sincere person made a mistake. The person has made an error. They have responsibility for the sin. It defiles them, but it is not the same as an act of rebellion or an act of pride or some other very intentional type of sin against God. Ta'a is to stray. In the Old Testament, life was thought to be ordered by Yahweh. And the covenant of God with Israel provided the ordering, which was expressed through primarily the laws of God. It provided the pattern for their lives, not just the religious cultists, but it provided a pattern for their lives in terms of their civil relationships, their family relationships, and their responsibilities to one another in a national sense. So it guided and directed many, many, many aspects of the people's lives. So Ta'a was to depart from these instructions that were given to the people under the law. And it could happen either by failure to obey the law, it could happen by accident, or it could happen by direct rebellion. So these are, it's a general term about straying, but the straying can happen intentionally, as in the case of Avon, or it can happen in a more accidental way, as would be in the case of Shagah. So any of these are something that could be found as various descriptions of sin and sinful acts in the Old Testament. And so it's important to understand kind of the dimensions here. The main dimensions of sin are failure to be God, pride, and intentional rebellion, and intentional disobedience or accidental disobedience to known laws and to the will of God. And these are the, if you take all of these things that I just read, these are the main points of sin that are reflected in the Old Testament. So one of the issues about sin and evil is that it is the act of temptation which challenges God's word or command. And this is what happened in the garden with Eve. It suggests that God's prohibitions only serve his own interests, and he is using fear to preserve his authority among humans. And that people could have good and desirable things that they are being kept from because God will not let them have that. And if you remember the temptation in Eden, this was exactly what the tempter said to Eve. Is it true that God said that you cannot eat of any of the fruit in the garden? And Eve said, no, only this fruit. We cannot eat of it. We cannot even touch it. Well, God didn't say you can't touch it. He only said you cannot eat of it. And so the tempter says to Eve, God doesn't want you to eat of it because you'll become like him. And she looked at it and it looked good, and you know, wouldn't it be great if you could be like God? Wouldn't he be happy with that kind of a relationship? Well, no, he is happy with obedience. This is the idea in the Old Testament. So she took of the fruit and she ate it. And of course, we know what happens. Well, the idea is the temptation is that God prohibits only to save his own authority and uses fear so that humans will not challenge his authority, and that if they did what they want, it would be something very desirable and make them very happy. And so God's commands are suggested by temptation as being bad, and they prevent humans from obtaining what is good, rather than preserving for humans what really and truly is good for them. In the temptation, then, the attitude is that man makes himself to be God. And by making oneself to be God and leading life by oneself rather than in obedience to and according to the will of God, then a person disrespects the commands of God, rebels against God, forgets the requirements of God, and opens the possibility for many, many other acts of sin and disobedience. So this is the effect of temptation and how temptation plays a strong role within a person and within the whole concept of sin and evil. Temptation is not made by God. Temptation is not made. And I think that's what's important to realize. Temptation happens spontaneously. And when temptation joins the thoughts and imaginations of a heart not oriented with God, sin occurs. So this is the Old Testament concept. Well, with any situation of sin and evil, as I said, there is the possibility of redemption. And so let me close this session by saying that there are four different words that are specifically associated with concepts of redemption in the Old Testament. And these words are Yeshua, which you probably recognize. This is the Hebrew word Jesus. But Yeshua signifies the idea of help and victory. And it was also simply a Hebrew word before it became a name associated with someone. Padha means to ransom or redeem, and Gaal was the kinsman redeemer or vindicator, which is the one who acted in the place of someone who was injured. And finally, there is Natsal, which means to deliver. And these different words are used to express different ways in which redemption in the face of evil and sin can take place.